One question that's come up is, do we think all companies will in the future have a say on director pay, if you will, like Tesla has agreed to? I think this is a very unique situation that led to this practice. I don't think we'll see that more broadly. So don't expect we'll have say on executive pay and say on director pay on an annual basis in the proxy statement.
Welcome to the Executive Compensation Podcast. On this show, we discuss all aspects of executive compensation. Whether you're a compensation committee member, a seasoned compensation professional, or just curious to learn more about executive compensation, then this show is the answer. Each episode brings you a focused and actionable interview on specific topics of executive compensation. This episode is brought to you by Meridian Compensation Partners. Meridian works with compensation committees to ensure the most effective processes are in place to go beyond mere compliance with governance requirements and create healthy, dynamic relationships between the board, management, and its advisors. Meridian helps boards use compensation to attract and retain critical talent and to make informed business decisions that will link pay and performance, drive business results, increase shareholder value, and mitigate potential risks. Learn more at meridiancp.com.
Welcome to the Executive Compensation Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Harvey, and on this episode, I'm joined by Michael Powers and Ron Rosenthal. Michael's a partner working out of our Meridian Lake Forest office, and Ron is a lead consultant working out of Chicago. Michael, Ron, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ryan. Happy to be here.
Thanks, Ryan. Good to be with you.
Great. Well, today we're going to be discussing director compensation. And as boards seek to attract diverse directors with key skills and experience, competitive and well-structured compensation is increasingly important. Director compensation is also unique from executive compensation. While compensation to board members needs to be competitive and attractive, it also must be structured in a way that's appropriate for an elected representative of shareholders. And on today's podcast, we're going to explore the primary elements of a well-designed director compensation structure, as well as some of the emerging trends. So Michael and Ron, I'd like to start by discussing the three major components of director compensation. As we know, a typical board package includes really three major elements: board retainers, equity awards, and typically some sort of committee-related pay. Also, I know that Meridian just completed its annual review of the S&P 500 director pay trends. So any data that we're seeing in that study, I think, would also be interesting to explore. But Michael, why don't we start with board retainers? What can you tell us about the purpose of a board retainer? How are they typically structured? And are there any trends that we're seeing in the data?
Yeah, happy to take that one, Ryan. And again, we'll reference the S&P 500 survey, both on pay levels and design practices. And it will be available on the Meridian website shortly for those who want to see the full report. With respect to board retainers, it is the second largest component of director pay, averaging around $100,000, most often paid in cash. Most organizations allow for tax deferral of the retainer as well, and potentially converting it into equity too. In essence, we think of the retainer as table stakes for director pay. And it's really to cover both the time and effort for being a publicly traded board member, but also for the attendant risk, whether they be financial or reputational. Over the last 10 years, we haven't seen much increase in retainers, really tracking with U.S. inflation rates, but it represents about one third of total director pay today. And most of the companies have a very tight range around the retainer. So the 25th percentile, for example, is about 90,000. The 75th percentile is only 120,000. And that compares to total board pay, which is more like 310,000 for that S&P 500 sample.
Have we seen any significant inflation in the retainer levels over recent years, or has it been pretty modest increases?
Very modest increases. Most boards, they like the mix between equity and that Ron will be talking about equity and cash, but most board members really don't want to have a significant increase in their fees. And if they are going to do that, most of that tends to be in equity or for some of the leadership roles that we'll be talking about later on the podcast.
Okay. Well, why don't we jump then to the next component, which is the equity grants. Ron, why don't you tell us a little bit more about how equity grants are usually structured and if there's any trends we're seeing in that category?
Sure, Ryan. Happy to. So for equity grants, first of all, companies typically denominate the annual equity grant as a dollar amount as opposed to granting a fixed number of shares. And the reason they typically do this is it provides consistency in the annual award value, even if there's year-over-year volatility in the share price. So like the annual retainer, as Michael was describing, companies will offer and target a specified dollar amount with the equity grant and grant that on an annual basis. Now, as Michael mentioned, equity is the majority of total annual compensation for an outside director. investors typically like to see at least half of a total annual compensation granted in equity. And in our study of the S&P 500 companies, equity, in fact, comprised 60% of total pay for an annual director. So as Michael mentioned, with median total pay for the S&P 500 companies just north of $300,000, the median annual equity grants for directors of S&P 500 companies was $180,000. So as I mentioned, about 60% of total pay. Those grants are typically structured as what we refer to as full value shares. So in other words, share denominated awards. Restricted stock units are the most common form of that annual equity grant. Over 50% of S&P 500 companies are granting the awards restricted stock units, followed by either fully vested shares of common stock or deferred share units, which each have about 20% prevalence. It's a very small minority practice for companies to grant stock options to directors, and the latest data shows it's now under 10%. And the reason for that is the director as a fiduciary of the company, it's really misaligned with their role as a fiduciary to grant stock options and certainly misaligned to grant performance-based awards, which we almost never see. So it's typically a full value share, and the trend has been to move away from deferred share units. If you roll the tapes back probably 20 years, deferred share units where the directors received a grant and couldn't have access to it until they left the board, that was very common structure. Today, the granting of a restricted stock unit is much more common, and deferred shares have declined in prevalence. What we found in our study is when the RSUs are granted, they typically have a one-year cliff vesting period attached to them. And the reason for that has to do with the timing and the nature of the grant. So the equity grant is typically awarded annually. The majority practice is now to grant that award coincident with the annual meeting date. I think about 70% of companies in our study do that. And the reason they do that is to align the grant with the director's election to the board and the upcoming year of service. What we found is these grants are often made on a prospective basis for the upcoming year of service. And therefore, many companies that grant RSUs have included a one-year vesting period just to ensure that the director provides the service that was expected when the award was granted. Now, do we still see companies make that equity grant on a calendar year basis? Yes, we certainly do. But that's in a small minority practice. As I mentioned, the more common approach is to grant it at the annual meeting date. Now, in terms of trends that we see with respect to the structuring of equity awards, I've already mentioned a couple of them. First is the last few years, we've seen a shift away from deferred share units, which have little flexibility, very prescriptive, no ability for the director to elect when to receive the grant. So we've seen a shift away from deferred share units to RSUs. Also seen more companies shift the timing of the grant to align with the annual meeting date. And for those that are adding RSUs and moving the award to the annual meeting date, we are seeing them add that one-year cliff vest to the awards. And the reason I think RSUs are increasing in popularity is there's the ability to make an elective deferral on the receipt of the underlying shares. So we're seeing companies not only move to RSUs, but also providing directors with the ability to make an elective deferral on those RSUs. And with that deferral, the thing that's nice about it is the director can choose whether to receive the shares and pay the tax on the vesting date or defer receipt and the taxable event until they leave the board. So if they'd rather have the income currently, they don't have to do anything. If they prefer to not lose leverage and push the taxable event out to future dates, for example, when they leave the board, with the elective deferral, they have the ability to do that. One of the other trends we're seeing is giving the directors the ability to make an elective deferral on the timing of the receipt of the underlying shares.
But just to reinforce that, you made this point when you were talking about the lack of prevalence in the use of stock options. But, you know, the one kind of glaring difference between executive pay and what we see in director pay is the lack of any incentive-based or performance-based compensation. And as you mentioned, it really boils down to the fact that board members are elected fiduciaries of shareholders. And so having them tied to a performance-based metric or a variable metric really can be problematic from that standpoint. So interesting difference there. But why don't we shift to kind of the third and final kind of big component, which is committee pay. And there could be a variety of different committees, a variety of different leadership responsibilities within those committees. But Michael, maybe talk to us a little bit about how boards typically structure pay for committee service.
Yeah, right. Happy to do so. And board committees essentially are where most of the work of boards gets done. The NYSE has listing requirements that say you have to have at least an audit committee, a compensation committee, and a governance committee. However, only a small minority of companies pay meeting fees for attendees at those meetings. And the reason really was over the last 15, 20 years is companies wanted to simplify the director pay practices. And they also didn't want to track administratively how often committees might have met. And that was particularly helpful during COVID when we moved to a lot of virtual meetings, a lot more frequent meetings, and didn't have to track when a particular committee was meeting or whether it was just a couple of directors having a conversation. So in lieu of those meeting fees over the last decade or so, most companies have either accelerated the retainer or the equity grant to make a competitive pay package. In contrast, committee chairs are paid for those roles. And that's really for the additional work of pre-meetings with management, post-meetings with management as advisor. Committee chairs also set meeting agendas for the committees, and they also report back to the full board on what the committee's activities were and what was approved. And some boards obviously allow board members to have access to all committee meeting materials as well. So for the pleasure of serving as a committee chair, typically audit committee chairs have an incremental fee of about $30,000. That's for 8 to 10 meetings a year. Compensation and nominating tend to meet less frequently than that, maybe 5-6 times a year. And the pay for those two roles is $25,000 for compensation and $20,000 for governance in our most recent survey. So bottom line is those are significant roles. And trust me, they earn those incremental dollars for being chair of those key committees.
Michael, have you seen, you know, I know in the past there is, and there still is a gap based on the data you just mentioned, a pretty big gap between audit and comp committee, and then even a bigger gap down to nom and gov. Any narrowing or widening of those gaps over the last 5 to 10 years?
I would say slight. It used to be audit was the clear leader, and part of that was because of additional responsibility, but also just the frequency with 10Q and other reporting requirements, meeting with the outside auditor. The audit committee 20 years ago was really significantly more responsibilities on that plate for the committee chair and also paid quite a bit more. In the last decade, though, compensation has been in the hot seat, certainly with more disclosure requirements. And actually, nom and gov is now in a hot seat with all the DEI trends that we're seeing and other ESG metrics. So all three committees are really critical these days. The role of the board has expanded fairly dramatically, as most of you know, and a lot of it is handled at the committee level.
Well, no, so I think we've kind of covered primary categories of board pay. So I want to just delve into a couple of other related topics. And Ron, maybe first of all, just want to talk a little bit about governance and director pay. So, you know, as we've already mentioned, directors are unique from employees in the fact that they are elected representatives of shareholders, and also the fact that they're in a unique position that they're designing and approving their own pay packages. So what are some of the unique aspects that a board should be cognizant of when it comes to governance of pay and approving of their own pay?
Yeah, no, great point, right? As you mentioned, the directors are fiduciaries. They have a duty of care. You know, they make informed decision making. They have a duty of loyalty to the shareholders. They have to act in good faith on an independent basis and act in the best interests of the company and its stockholders. And so, as you mentioned, there is inherent conflict of interest because they have these overarching duties, but at the same time, there is no one else to set director pay. The directors have to set their own pay. Management can't do it, and they have an inherent conflict of interest that they cannot avoid. So some of the steps that companies take to protect the board and to shield the company from a potential litigation on director pay, first is to have the compensation reviewed at the committee level. Practices are split, majority at the compensation committee, but a good number at the nominating and governance committee oversee director pay as well. Good practice to review the director pay program on a regular basis. That's typically annually or biennially. Engaging the board's independent consultant to conduct a market study of the director pay program, pay levels, pay design, and have the consultant prepare a written report with relevant market information so that informs the committee's decision-making process. So having the documentation, the supports for the committee's consideration of the design of the program is important. And also important to put very clear disclosure in the annual proxy statement about the process for reviewing director compensation, as well as the decision, so the shareholders understand the process underlying the committee's and the board's decision in setting its own pay. And another step some companies have taken in order to limit risk is, in the last, I'd say, 5+ years, is to include meaningful limits in the equity plan governing awards to directors. Now, that could be limited to the maximum amount of compensation that will be granted in equity to a director. Usually, it's meaningful, but it gives a company enough flexibility to award the desired amount, or the board the flexibility to award the desired amount of equity to directors. And some companies will even include an overarching limit that covers cash and directly compensation that can be granted to directors. So those are some steps that boards can take, committees can take, in order to manage the risk where they have this inherent conflict of interest.
Well, great, Ron. Anything else related to governance or current trends in that area that you'd like to discuss?
There's one recent case related to director pay that folks may be aware of, and I just wanted to spend a minute giving an overview on it and some of the key takeaways, Ryan. So as many may be aware, Tesla settled a derivative lawsuit for $735 million derivative suit, so the money is returned to the company. Just for background, the suit was filed by one of its investors, a pension plan, in 2020, alleging that the current and former directors paid themselves excessive compensation. The complaint sought to have the board members disgorge option awards, make reforms to board pay practices, and even sought a declaration that the defendants had breached their fiduciary duties to Tesla and its shareholders, which we just spoke about. And so recently that case was settled. The directors will have to return $735 million paid either by forfeiting stock options, returning cash, or returning Tesla stock. They agreed not to receive any compensation for a three-year period, 21, 22, and 2023. And in terms of the process we were just discussing, they've agreed to conduct an annual review of all director compensation, cash and equity, on an annual basis. They've also agreed to engage an independent consultant annually to advise the committee in connection with that review and assessment. And the committee will be responsible, as we've discussed, for recommending to the board, on the basis of that annual review and assessment, the amount and type of compensation to be paid to the directors. They have to review pay annually, so they've agreed to conduct that review on an annual basis. And what's somewhat unique is they agreed to submit the proposed annual compensation to be paid to the directors to a shareholder vote, and it has to be approved by a majority of the unaffiliated shareholders. Of course, with the ownership structure at Tesla, they made the point to say that the unaffiliated shareholders have to approve the proposal. And so as part of that say on director pay, the company has to disclose their philosophy on director pay, the process for the review, and the proposed compensation on a director by director basis. And so you can see some of the kind of good governance practices that are built into the process and captured in the settlement. One question that's come up is, do we think all companies will in the future have a say on director pay, if you will, like Tesla has agreed to? I think this is a very unique situation that led to this practice. I don't think we'll see that more broadly. So don't expect we'll have say on executive pay and say on director pay on an annual basis in the proxy statement.
Right. All good things to consider and incorporate into the process. So the last topic I wanted to touch on, and this could easily be its own topic for a podcast, but I want to just briefly talk a little bit about leadership, board leadership, how that's structured and how that's compensated. So there's kind of three primary leadership roles that we'll see in some fashion or another at companies. Outside chair of the board would be one. Lead director is another role that we often will see. And then an executive chair is a role that we see occasionally. And I think there's probably been a slight increase in executive chairs in recent years. So, Michael, I'd like to just spend a little bit of time. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how those roles are typically compensated and any other considerations we might want to be aware of in those leadership roles.
Sure thing. And we have seen probably this is the area of most dynamic change in our board compensation. And the leadership roles have seen the largest pay increases, I would say, over the last 5 to 10 years. And as Ryan said, there's really three that we'd like to cover. First is the lead director. And in instances where the CEO is also the chair, the lead director is typically paid an increment of about $50,000 over and above a regular board member. And that is really for three roles, reviewing and approving sometimes, but at least reviewing board meeting agendas and materials. Second is to run the executive sessions of the board. And third is to be the primary interface with the CEO. Again, that's when the CEO and the chair is really one person. So a lead director is a nice counterbalance to that. They can also speak publicly on behalf of the company on important governance matters. They can engage with major institutional shareholders or shareholder advisory groups. And honestly, many lead directors really don't want to be singled out. They view themselves as a peer of other board members, but the reality is it is a significant role and it helps demonstrate the importance of that role to institutional shareholders and shareholder advisory groups as well, so to compensate that. And so they are paid a moderate delta above the audit chair. The second role is the non-executive chairman, really an independent board member typically. Almost half of the S&P 500 have this role currently, and they average about $200,000 in incremental compensation, often just in equity. And so their responsibilities are a little different in that they determine the board agenda. They approve the meeting materials and they also run the board meeting. They also certainly can represent the company with external constituencies. So it's really a critical role for most boards that have a non-executive chair. And then the third role we wanted to talk briefly about is executive chair. And this one has changed a lot over the last 5 to 10 years, I would say. It was not a common practice 10 years ago. Today, there are a good number of CEOs who transition into retirement by becoming the executive chair and giving up the CEO role. And as Ryan said, we can have an entire podcast just on the pros and cons of having an executive chair, the duration of those roles, the responsibilities of those roles. But at a high level, in terms of their compensation, there's usually a fairly substantial haircut from their pay as CEO. Often they don't participate in equity incentives. They might not participate in the annual incentive as well, but they still have a very significant total pay package, which is a multiple of the non-executive chair. So bottom line is that role definition takes a lot of board dialogue in terms of, do we want to have that role? How long will the person stay on as executive chair? And what is fair compensation for the role? The other more subtle item built into those continuation of employee status, because they are an employee as executive chair, is the continuation of some retirement programs, but certainly the continuation of vesting on equity incentives, which can be very substantial. So those are the kind of things that we have a lot of dialogue and conversation with full boards about as a CEO is nearing retirement age.
Yeah, no, great summary of those roles, and would agree that particularly that executive chair role is of the three by far the most unique and probably most complicated from a pay perspective, and often very much driven by the role itself, because the role of executive chair can mean something very different, you know, depending on how it's structured across companies. So maybe that will be a future topic we can delve into. Well, this has been a great discussion. As we've seen on this conversation, board compensation, while it is generally simpler than executive pay, and the actual dollar amounts we're talking about are often much less than executive pay, it could be a very important issue and really a driving factor in high-functioning boards. So, Michael, Ron, thanks again for joining the podcast today.
Happy to do it. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Executive Compensation Podcast. You can see more about this episode along with additional executive compensation insights at meridiancp.com. That's Meridian, the letter C, and the letter P.com. This episode is brought to you by Meridian Compensation Partners. Meridian works with compensation committees to ensure the most effective processes are in place to go beyond mere compliance with governance requirements and create healthy, dynamic relationships between the board, management, and its advisors. Meridian helps boards use compensation to attract and retain critical talent and to make informed business decisions that will link pay and performance, drive business results, increase shareholder value, and mitigate potential risks. Learn more at meridiancp.com.